The Month in Review. February may be the shortest month of the year, but it was still jam-packed with news. Among the headlines, the governor unveiled her two-year budget proposal. The legislature began debate on a wide variety of bills, from auto inspections to plastic bag bans to paid leave. Maine's congressional delegation joined resolutions opposing the president's national emergency. Wind blew over a communications tower atop Sugarloaf Mountain. And people all over the state engaged in a debate over which chickadee ought to be the state bird. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today, three Maine editorial page editors join us to discuss these news stories and more. Which Maine news stories mattered most to you this past month? Which will you continue to follow? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. It is a short month, but there has been no shortage of news here in Maine in February. Today, we'll talk about what Governor Mills has been doing so far, what is happening with the CMP Clean Energy Connect plan, past Governor LePage's spending at the Trump Hotel, and other top stories of this past month. Joining me today, our panel of editorial page editors. With me in our Portland studio, Ben Bragdon, who is with the Kennebec Journal, Morning Sentinel, and Central Maine Sunday, and Greg Kessich with the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. And joining us from our Bangor studio, Susan Young with the Bangor Daily News. As always, we want to hear from you. What do you think of Governor Mills' actions so far? Do you have questions about the Maine state bird? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Funny, it feels like just yesterday you all were sitting here in the studio with us. But let's start at the beginning of the month. February 8th, Governor Mills set out her two-year budget proposal, which lays out fiscal priorities for the new administration. Susan Young, what did we learn, and were there any surprises?
Continuing her theme of hope, she put together a budget that actually spends money on what she has heard from Maine folks are their priorities: healthcare, education, opioid addiction. She did not raise taxes, which was a campaign pledge, so has some of us, including our editorial board, a little concerned about how the math works out. They're basing their spending on projections from the Revenue Forecasting Commission, which, you know, that's their job to come up with accurate numbers, but a lot of concern that we could see an economic downturn in the next 18 months or so, and what happens then. So we're kind of taking a wait and see approach, especially on the revenue side. You know, how long can this no new taxes pledge hold? So sets up an interesting dynamic in the legislature. Republicans have already been very critical of her budget proposal, saying that, you know, it's unrealistic, unsustainable because the revenue won't be there. Haven't heard as much from the far left of the Democratic caucus, who will be not so happy that there's not rollbacks in the LePage era tax cuts. They were hoping to see some tax increases, especially on wealthy Mainers, to pay for increases in funding for things like education and helping with the drug crisis. So it's going to be really interesting to see how this all plays out in the legislature.
Ben, who's happy, who's unhappy with what she's put out so far?
It's a little hard to tell. I mean, certainly the Republicans are don't believe she can kind of pull it off. But it's kind of in the middle there. It's on the one hand, she has this huge increase in the budget, going from 7.23 billion to 8, and so it's this huge spending increase. But she did it without a tax increase, as Susan said. She did it without raiding the rainy day fund. But she also didn't fully fund schools at 55%, which was one thing that progressives want. She didn't fully fund revenue sharing, the sales tax that goes back to municipalities. So even with that big increase, there were other things she could have done. So that's kind of, I think, going to be where it plays out in the legislature, plus whatever priorities lawmakers have in the bills that weren't included in the budget. And so that's kind of where all the tension is going to be. And, of course, the Republicans are saying that's too high of a number for the budget. So that's kind of where the fight's going to be.
Greg, I know a lot of people think of this two-year budget proposal as, you know, in part laying out the fiscal priorities, but also just sort of a roadmap for where a governor's philosophical priorities are.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's interesting in that light. There's no major new policy initiative in the budget. There's no you know, free college tuition, no universal health care. You know, some of the sort of the big philosophical issues that are really important to progressives. There are bills to do some of those things that'll be going through the process this year that will need, you know, if they were to pass, would need funding and would have impact. But the picture I have is that they're putting a value in competent governance, that they want to, you know, keep the doors open, be able to continue to serve the people of the state, maybe better than they have been in the past. But instead of just sort of remaking the world, they appear to be trying to, kind of settle down and have like a sound government.
And it also seems as though maybe methodically undoing some of the
right
things in the LePage administration. Of course, Medicaid expansion is probably the biggest, but unjoining this coalition of states that supports offshore drilling. That just happened this past week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she said a number of things that she could kind of tick off her list very quickly because they were things, whether federal money or like the offshore coalition that you just have to, you know, resign from. She had all these things that Governor LePage had kind of undone that she could redo with a signature or a few changes. So it's really seemed like it's really felt like she's had this really aggressive first couple of months, and she has. But a lot of it is just kind of getting up to what Democrats would think of as just kind of a baseline for state government.
Let's talk about U.S. Senator Susan Collins, who has had a lot of people on the left angry with her. A slew of things happening recently, Susan, that may have people on the right not happy with her. She has joined a bipartisan joint resolution to terminate the president's national emergency declaration opposing the environmental protection nominee. And standing firm on some things that the right would like her to go the other way.
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, you know, she'd had a lot of folks on the left upset about her with her since the Kavanaugh vote and other issues late last year. So it was kind of perhaps an unexpected turn to have her announce that she would vote against Andrew Wheeler, who, if it's possible, may be worse than Scott Pruitt, at least in terms of policy initiatives at the EPA, and then being the first Republican to come out against the president's emergency declaration on wall funding. So, you know, we're all waiting to see when and if she announces that she's running for re-election in the Senate, which I think we all expect is forthcoming. But I think we'll continue to see some of these swings back and forth, which she's done throughout her career, depending on the issue, the person. Sometimes, you know, she's on the right, sometimes she's on the left. It felt like she had been on the right and in some people's minds, the far right for quite some time, but has now, on these two issues at least, moved back to the left. So, you know, continue to wait and see as things develop with her reelection campaign.
So with that, our entire delegation is opposing the president's border wall funding and is declaring a national emergency to get that. We're also have joined other states, I think it's 16 total, to sue. Does this mean something for, does this mean anything for Maine politically? Is there a retribution?
I don't think so. You know, a lot of this from Congress is not so much. I mean, you can see it in the way that, that Senator Collins makes her pitch for it. It's not really so much about the, you know, and this straight up criticism of the president. It's about Congress holding on to its, you know, its powers. In separation of powers, they get to decide how money is spent, and not through these, through some, you know, national emergencies, power grab type of thing. So I'm not sure that there's anything that's going to come back on that.
Greg, the Portland Press Herald broke the story of how much money former Governor Paula Page spent at the Trump Hotel while he was governor. I'd like you to tell us the backstory to this. This was a FOIA request that was pretty old, wasn't it? The
it
request
was
made a while ago.
I wish I had I wish I had the exact dates, but this was a couple of our reporters, Scott Thistle and Kevin Miller, started digging into what this is a time early in the Trump administration when the governor was going to D.C. a lot, and he was sometimes going to meet with the president, and sometimes he was going to testify, and you know, other official business. But they requested through the open records law information about where he was staying and how much it was costing. And you know, it's a pretty standard kind of watchdog journalism type request. So this dates back to, I'd say, like, you know, the middle of 2017, and the governor's office would not turn over the information. At one point, the Department of Public Safety turned over, you know, released information about the Secret Service detail, which was not Secret Service, Maine State Police detail that is there to protect him, and it was clear they were staying at the Trump Hotel at times. It just, I think this is a lesson, well, for us in journalism, it's a lesson in staying on the story and being persistent. But for readers, I think it's also a lesson in when somebody doesn't want to tell you something, there's usually a pretty good reason. And it's not just that I don't feel like talking to you. It's that they had spent $22,000 at least. They were going out for lavish meals at the Trump restaurant, and aside from being, you know, exposing him as a little bit hypocritical, you know, he's cutting back food for poor kids, you know, talking about wanting to be fiscally responsible while he's spending lavishly on himself and his family. It also ties into a big national story, which is the there's two lawsuits involving the governments of District of Columbia and Maryland, which are suing the Trump Hotel under the or suing the president under the federal Constitution's Emoluments Clause, which is, says that they can't take any favors from heads of government. And at the time of the founders, this was a concern that they had, that that governors of states would come down and give money to the president to get favorable treatment. And so this is going to be wrapped up in that that whole story. And part of the reason that the governor of Maine is involved in it is because the newspaper were publishing these stories.
Yeah, it really shows how weak a lot of these transparency laws are, and that you can just ignore them and not really get any penalty. And you can really put it off for a long time. You probably couldn't keep them hidden forever, you know, because of change in his administration or eventual lawsuit that would get through. But you can, you know, postpone it for a long time. You can keep things hidden for years. And if no one presses you, or if no one has the ability to press you, you know, they don't have the money for a lawsuit, then you can just keep them hidden. And, you know, what we had here was the governor of Maine spending taxpayer money at the president's private business. And we didn't know about it for more than a year and a half. The laws aren't there the laws are there to say we need this information right now. It's public information. You need to turn it over. It's not, you know, for historians to go back years later and look at what Paula Page had for dinner. It's for the people to know as it's happening what their government's doing.
Susan, Chief Justice Lee Softly gave her State of the Judiciary speech this past Tuesday. She did not focus on the needs of the courts, but rather Maine's vulnerable youth. You find this notable?
Absolutely. I mean, typically she has raised these concerns in the past, but she asked for more money for the court system so that the court system can improve juvenile justice and justice for other groups as well. So what was notable was that, you know, she asked for some changes within the court system, but she wasn't really asking for money directly for the judicial system, but instead imploring the governor and legislature to focus on both the opiate crisis and also the state's treatment and where we take care of juveniles who are in the correctional system, and tell, you know, again, reiterating to them, as she has in the past, that we need to change laws, change systems, perhaps have different facilities to ensure that we are rehabilitating our youth who are in the criminal justice system, not in some ways, you know, making their lives much worse, especially if they're held at the Long Creek facility in South Portland. But and on the same idea, making sure that there are better treatment options for folks struggling with substance abuse disorder. And it was also interesting to note, the Bangor Daily News reported this morning that the Department of Corrections wants to begin housing female inmates at Long Creek because there's so much extra space there. So that opens up the question, you know, is the state correctional system looking at alternative uses for that facility and ultimately moving children out of that facility, which has not been terribly well run, and making sure they're in more appropriate settings that focus on that rehabilitation and not punishment, so that they will go on to lead better lives. So again, another issue to keep an eye on as it appears that we're going to have changes in that system.
Yeah, it looks like the corrections department is going to make a lot of news in the Mills administration. Randall Liberty is heading it up. He was a Kennebec County Sheriff. He's a veteran and Kennebec County Sheriff, and then headed up the Maine State Prison in Warren under Governor LePage. And he's always been very reform-minded, very open to new ideas that don't involve locking people up for long periods of time without help. And so whether it's, you know, the changes at Long Creek, eventually, you know, getting rid of Long Creek, or introducing drug treatment into prisons, or any other of these you know, reforms that we probably really need to have in Maine, I think they're gonna move pretty quickly to change a lot of stuff.
We have so much more to talk about. We need to take a quick break. We need to talk about the psychiatric facility in Bangor, some of the bills before the legislature right now, and of course, the great Chickadee debate. If you would like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the Finance Authority of Maine, providing financial solutions that help Maine people achieve their business and higher educational goals. FameMaine.com. And InSource Renewables, committed to providing renewable energy solutions that support Maine's communities, workers, and the planet. InSourceRenewables.com.
The summit between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un wraps up its final day. So, was it a success?
If it makes North Korea to allow in some sunshine and some cooperation, my view is that's actually a step in the right direction.
Plus, the latest on Michael Cohen's testimony before Congress this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered is today at 4 here on Maine Public Radio. Have you subscribed to The 10 yet? The 10 is Maine Public's free weekly emailed newsletter, our curated look at 10 exceptional, thought-provoking, and compelling stories, not necessarily from the front page, that you may have missed during the week, chosen from Maine Public, NPR, PBS, American Public Media, PRX, the BBC, and more. To sign up or to read past issues, go to mainpublic.org and click on the news dropdown. Enjoy.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the top news stories of February. Joining me today, three newspaper editors, Susan Young with the Bangor Daily News, Greg Kasich with the Portland Press Herald, and Ben Bragdon at the Kennebec Journal, all editorial page editors. We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I want to bring up Governor Mills' support for the CMP plan to bring energy from Quebec to Massachusetts, the Clean Energy Connect transmission line project. But I'm going to let Kai from Fitchburg ask the question since he's on the line and wants to talk about that. Hi, Kai. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Good afternoon. I was wondering, why can Maine not purchase all of its power from Hydro-Québec? The power plants are there. They are in use. The electricity is being produced, whether we use it or not. And, I mean, it's going to Massachusetts. They got 6.8 million people. We got 1.2, and we're much closer. So, I mean, you know, we used to have Maine Yankee, and that was okay. So what is the reason why we're not purchasing from Hydro-Québec?
I can take that. I mean, it's an issue with the amount of transmission. There are transmission lines that go from Hydro-Québec through New Brunswick into Maine. There's also ones that go into other parts of the Northeast through New York State. This power would, if this line is built, would transmit power that was bought by Massachusetts, but it would go to Maine. I mean, the way electricity circulates is that you can't just run a pipe from Quebec to Boston. It just goes into the system. And we're in a regional market where all the electricity is bought from different generation sources. Except for Vermont, everybody's deregulated, meaning that the generators are just sort of in an auction. It's selling their power, and the system buys it at the specific prices. This power plant and this power line would offset the loss of a nuclear plant that is going to be retired, and it's producing somewhere around 800. I'm going to get this wrong. Megawatts now, and when it retires, it will. They'll need to make up for that power. So that's the trade-off. Whether we could get all of our power from Hydro-Québec, I suppose that I don't know that they have the capacity to give the entire state meet its electric needs. But this project would put the Hydro-Québec power on our grid.
Kai, thanks for your call. And let's talk a little further about this, because Governor Mills really made some big news when she announced that she would support the current negotiated proposal for the New England Clean Energy Connect project. Really, the reason she's done so is because the bucket of benefits for Maine and Maine ratepayers is much higher than the earlier proposal. But still, Ben, a lot of people are mad at her. How much does this affect her politically, and how much does her support for the project really matter?
Well, to take the second question, I think it matters a great deal. This benefits package that she has signed on to between CMP and a bunch of other stakeholders, including a couple of environmental groups that are backing the plan, will go into the file for this plan for when the Public Utilities Commission sits down to decide whether this plan whether they're going to approve the plan. And having this benefits package there signed by the governor will go a long way to showing that there's state support for it and that convincing them that there are benefits. Politically, I don't know. It's hard to tell. I mean, there's certainly, there was a meeting the other night up in Farmington, up in the governor's hometown, and there's a lot of opposition up there. A lot of people angry at the governor for coming out like this when she was kind of, she was saying wait and see during the campaign. And then so they feel like she's kind of flipped on it. But long term, I can't imagine it having too much of an impact. Sometimes when these things, the fight's the biggest deal. And then once they get going, it kind of fades. But then she's also on the other side. A lot of these people are talking about this, focusing on the environment. The governor just today just announced this big climate change plan. One of the groups that has been her chief detractor in the CMP plan was applauding her for this. So they're not always going to be on the other side of issues.
All right, Susan, before we move on to another topic, anything you'd like to add about the announcement by Governor Mills that she is going to support the current negotiated proposal for the New England Clean Energy Connect transmission line?
I mean, for regulators, this still has to be approved by the PUC and the Maine Department of Environmental Protection. There's still a lot of unanswered questions because Hydro-Québec technically is not a party to this. CMP is who is before regulators. Is this truly clean power, or is it new power? Are they going to divert power from Ontario and other places? And this, as Greg said, the power is being purchased by Massachusetts. Yes, it will be on the New England grid. But for regulators, particularly the PUC, the question is, does this benefit the state of Maine? Mm-hmm. And that's somewhat of an open question. Yes, there's the benefits package, and rates will be somewhat lower on the generation side. But long term, what are the benefits for Maine? Will it offset the development of green renewable power in the state? If so, how much? And is that, a negative that outweighs some of the other positives? So I think the governor's support is certainly important before the PUC, but they still have to really focus on that question of overall benefits to the state before they can get to a position of approving the project.
In terms of the politics of it, it's really complicated. You have this very strange alliance. You have on one hand, you have the natural gas generators, the existing power plants are lobbying against it, along with the Natural Resources Council of Maine, and on the other side, you have CMP and Union of Concerned Scientists and the Conservation Law Foundation, who are saying it's good for the climate. And then, the opponents are saying that it's not going to be good for the climate, and that that hydropower is not even clean power because it releases all kinds of greenhouse gases from these big lakes that are on top of forests. So there's not. You don't see the usual teams. everybody's kind of changed sides on this one.
Yeah, and it's also enormously bad timing from Central Maine Power.
Yeah,
they've been trying to get this multi-billion dollar project built at the same time that they're having all these problems with their billing system and all their problems with their reliability. I mean, no one is willing to take to give them the benefit of the doubt right now. And with a lot of these science questions up in the air, you kind of have to take them take their word for it on some of this stuff if you're going to support them. And no one's really willing to listen to them right now.
Really interesting sort of combination of bills before the Maine legislature so far this session. The bill that would be forbidding something I'd never heard of, food shaming in Maine schools, the idea that kids who haven't paid their bills have a different school lunch, somehow are called out, a bill against that. Auto inspection bill has resurfaced, as it does every couple years. plastic bag ban. Some municipalities have done this, but this would be a statewide ban. Susan, what are you watching, and what do you think actually has a chance of passing?
There are many things to watch, from the small to, you know, bigger picture issues. Still a lot of bills on the opioid crisis and healthcare, things that we think are somewhat settled, but still funding issues, structural issues that need to be tackled by the legislature. But you're right, it certainly is an interesting mix. And the emergency of, I think, last week on edibles, and is CDB good or bad, and should it be taken off the shelves because it was dangerous? The state said yes, and then they kind of apologized, but still illegal, especially under the federal government. So all this confusion,
and still
about,
on store,
you know, this
shelves.
New cash crop, yeah, this new cash crop. So, you know, that's, we laugh about it, but for the folks involved, you know, it's a serious issue and something that needs clarity right away. And then the other issue is, you know, what's still going to be on the table in April, hopefully not in June, you know, as the budget is always the last thing to get finalized. But there'll still be a lot of these other issues, school funding, for example, that mm-hmm. will still be up for debate at the end of the session.
Let's take one of the bills, though, that there's a push to mandate paid sick leave. We have a Democratic governor, a Democratic legislature. Is there a chance that this passes?
There was a very lively hearing about it this week. I think, you know, there's certainly a chance. I think there's a lot of business interests that have just as much hold on Democrats as they do on Republicans. In many cases, bigger businesses that already offer this benefit but don't want to be required to offer it. It's one of those issues where America is a real outlier in the world and in the industrialized world about the kind of benefits that people get or people expect. Yes, I mean, they've been trying to pass a similar version on a local level in Portland. And, you know, one of the arguments is it really should be dealt with on a statewide basis.
One of the things pushing the politics of this, too, is that the Maine People's Alliance has, which is a progressive group that has been very successful getting minimum wage and the school funding and the home care one from the last election onto the ballot. They were collecting signatures for a paid leave referendum for 2019. But when Janet Mills won, they decided, and the legislature went Democratic, they decided to give the legislature a chance. But they could still put it on the 2020 ballot. So that's hanging over the heads. And opponents know this. Like, they fought minimum wage increases forever until it became clear that there was going to be a minimum wage increase, and then they wanted to be involved to keep it from being too much, and the legislature kind of said screw off, and they went their own way. But they don't want to get caught in that situation again, so they might there's probably room here for some sort of compromise that satisfies, you know, people on both sides.
We'll go to a tweet from Jim. He says, here's a thought in regards to public information law. Just as we ask police officers to wear body cams, perhaps politicians while doing public work should have to wear body cams. So the former Governor LePage with a body cam on.
But who's going to watch the video?
Yeah.
So an email from Rick. With all the new spending and no tax increases, how does Governor Mills' budget balance? What's being cut, or does the budget use unrealistic revenue projections? We talked about this a little bit, that it is using the projections that are provided to it.
Yeah, and I think the projections under the LePage administration were held back a little bit. And I think he you know, if anything, tried to underspend. So that's why we got the rainy day fund. And you can argue, you know, which side is appropriate. But yeah, I mean, the forecasters, which are the same nonpartisan forecasters everyone uses, are saying that there's going to be plenty of money for it. The question becomes, you know, does that hold up, or do we hit a recession at some point, or, you know, and then how do you deal with that?
I mean, after the recession in 2007 and 2008, when every report had revenue shortfalls and they were just using the sequester and cutting things left and right. I think there was a desire to be conservative, and those are the projections she's using. The conservative, not overestimating. There's been some economic growth.
We'll go to Marilyn, who's calling from Newcastle. Hi, Marilyn. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Two things I think Governor Mills is a little off on with her backing of NECEC, or hasn't checked into appropriately, are, one, she says electric bills are going to, CMP's told her electric bills are going to drop on household accounts. That's $1.58 a month. I don't think that's going to make a lot of difference, but maybe it will. I don't know. I don't think it does. But the second thing is Kirsten Hillman was on your show the other day, the Deputy Minister of Trade from Canada. And in her talks with you, she mentioned some sort of an agreement, and I didn't write down or can't remember what she said about electric car charging stations. You said something about Canada and Maine had an agreement to put some car charging stations in the state, and that's one of the big things Governor Mills is touting about CMP's great things they're going to do if we back an ECEC.
Yeah, that was one of the sweeteners, was that the project would produce money for car charging stations. You know, the argument about dropping electric bills is kind of complicated. It's basically, I think what they're saying is it'll put downward pressure on electric bills. And the way that would work is if Massachusetts was buying this big bulk power and they're out of the market, that means there's less demand in the auction system. And so when there's less demand, prices go down, but how you have to know you have to have two alternate universes going at the same time to know what the price would have been if you hadn't done it.
Marilyn, thanks.
I would just add there's two pieces that go into what you see on your bill, and Marilyn raises a really good point. I mean, as part of this agreement, my understanding is that there's a pledge to reduce rates on the generation side. CMP doesn't generate power. CMP is on the transmission and distribution side. And in recent years, CMP and Emera Maine up here, their rates have gone up and up, and they've gone to the PUC, not yearly, but quite frequently in recent years, for increases. So I think folks are right to be skeptical. Okay, it's great that on the generation side, prices will go down. But are we going to see increases in the transmission and distribution side? You know, CMP's got to pay for this line. And so at some level, that cost is going to be passed on to the ratepayers. So will they see increases down the road
I think Massachusetts is paying for the line 100%. This won't get put into the main customers' base.
And there's some also,
as you pointed out before, we're all part of the same electric grid.
I'm
going to hold my breath on that
okay.
one.
Marilyn, thanks for your call. If you'd like to join the conversation about the news headlines for the month of February, your thoughts about Maine news from the month of February, give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Evergreen Home Performance, dedicated to helping homeowners qualify for efficiency Maine energy audit and insulation rebates. More at evergreenyourhome.com. Black Cow Burgers and Fries, a cocktail bar and soda fountain on Exchange Street in Portland with dine-in or takeout service, blackcowburgers.com. And The Grasshopper Shop of Rockland, offering items for your body, mind, and home since 1975, grasshoppershopofrockland.com.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about President Trump's Secretary of State and former CIA Director Mike Pompeo with Mattathias Schwartz, a contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine. Schwartz says this week's North Korea meeting is the latest challenge in Pompeo's balancing act. That balancing act is the subject of Schwartz's new article. Join us.
Fresh Air is this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio. And coming up today at 2, World Affairs, France's Yellow Vests and the Future of Europe. The three-month-old Yellow Vest movement in France is the largest protest the country has seen in decades. While protesters hail from diverse backgrounds, what they do share is a deep resentment towards both their government and their nation's elites. What does this mean for the future of Europe?
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the news that made headlines this month. Our panel of editorial page editors is back with us. Greg Kesich with the Portland Press Herald, Susan Young with the Bangor Daily News, and Ben Bragdon with the Kennebec Journal. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. I'm going to go to, let's see here, William on Facebook. It says, and this is for you, Susan, Bangor Daily News recently asked for public input on improving their Facebook comment feed. If you look online, it is filled with hostile commentary towards our politicians and the BDN directly. What kinds of ways can the unproductive hatred be curbed online?
Online comments on our own website, not the Facebook.
Okay, yeah.
Well,
and I
have
to be honest, Susan, whether it's your paper or Ben or yours, Greg, is I find sometimes the comments just, you know, reprehensible and kind of just very base, very low.
Yeah, absolutely. We have to.
That's absolutely true. And that's why we're undertaking this effort to try and make them better. Trying to be optimistic about it, but having watched our comments section for years, you're right. I mean, whenever folks contribute something to our paper, you know, they ask, do we have any suggestions? And it's like, don't read the comments because you're just going to get really upset and depressed. And, you know, I think it fairly begs the question, why do we have comment sections when we know they're so bad? But we're really trying to engage our audience and have a productive discussion. So one thing we've already been doing is having reporters and editors join the discussion, which surprisingly so far has been helpful and well received by our commenters. I think it, you know, knowing that they're being watched and that someone's going to chime in and try and redirect or answer their questions or maybe tell them, you know, you're not being appropriate, has changed behavior a little bit, obviously very early in this process. But, you know, we're also ongoing debate, and it's been really interesting to see people in the comments section discussing the comment policy in a productive, helpful way. You know, is anonymity a good thing or a bad thing? And they had valid arguments on both sides. Should every comment be moderated before it's allowed to go live, or should we rely on the community to police itself? And again, the folks in that comment community were having a good discussion about that and raised valid points on both sides. So very early in the process, and, you know, we're learning as we go along, but, you know, we're maybe hoping against hope to make the comment section better. But, you know, it would be sad if we just had to shut it down and we couldn't have that community commentary. But our goal is to have a more productive, less insulting dialogue on the issues affecting the state.
And it affects your staffing, isn't it? I mean, it's no secret that newspapers across the country are having to tighten their belt. And you spend money on a reporter going in the field and gathering, you know, stories, or somebody policing the comment section,
well,
right?
You do some of it, but you can't expect everybody who writes a piece to spend the whole day following the comments and responding to a lot of, you know, it does take time. It's really sad that this technology that was supposed to bring people together is this, you know, avenue for people to be really nasty. And I would say one thing, Susan. We tried having comments that weren't anonymous a few years ago, and the result was, like, the really horrific comments, the people who make them don't think they're bad. So they were fine. They were fine with having their name attached. It was the, you know, somebody who, like, knows something about a topic, who, like, works in the field and doesn't want to expose themselves. Those were the comments we lost. And it's funny, if you track them, every once in a while there's an issue that hasn't broken down politically yet. And you can get a really interesting string of comments, like, you know, fishing regulations or something. And then, but once there's a left-right, frame for it, forget it. It's over.
We'll go to Adam, who's calling from Westbrook. Hi, Adam. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm wondering how much you think the sort of animosity and distrust of CMP is sort of overshadowing decisions by environmental groups or energy-related groups in endorsing or opposing the NECEC project?
Interesting question. Thoughts?
I don't know. I guess I think it's just making it easier not to trust CMP. Otherwise, I think this is a pretty classical environmental fight in the woods. I mean, we've seen this. This was kind of the same, a lot of the same arguments that were being made when Plum Creek was trying to develop a bunch of area up in Moosehead. I mean, it seems like it's a lot of kind of the same thing. Like someone from outside sees value in what we have in the woods and wants to come up and use that value, and then they're trying to figure out how much they have to pay for that, right? Mm-hmm. So it seems like it's kind of broken down that way.
But I wonder if you might be onto something. I think CMP is a corporation that makes its money by building transmission lines and maintaining them, and they're regulated by the state. And they have a certain profit margin,
and they're owned by a Spanish company.
Yeah, and they have shareholders, and they have a duty to their shareholders to produce so much return. And I think there's a feeling that we've overbuilt transmission in some areas. We haven't done enough to other parts of the grid to make it move more smoothly. People are upset about the response times and certain outages. So I think that is part of the mix in terms of how people respond to this, how they feel about CMP. And right now, very few people are feeling like warm and fuzzy.
Adam, thanks for calling in. We're going to go to Jack calling from Wallagrass. Hi, Jack.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I appreciate your call and the fact that you have three newspapers there. I'd like to raise a question of the editor's page that each of the papers published. You cannot access it unless you're a subscriber. And I certainly understand the need for raising money. However, I'm not interested in always the nitty-gritty of the Portland newspaper or maybe the Bangor newspaper. But I would be interested in some of the editorial pages, and I certainly don't have enough money to subscribe to the monthly editorial or the full-page editions via the Internet.
So Jack, are you suggesting perhaps an alternate kind of subscription to letters to the editor and things like that?
Either that, or if they're open, I can open up the front page and I'm, quote, limited to 5 articles or 10 articles, depends on the newspaper. And after that, I get a little note that says, sorry, you reached your limit. And yet I think there's a lot of good that the editorial pages particularly came out with prior to, before the election and such, that because there is a political difference between Portland and Bangor and Aroostook County, and it would be interesting to have access to that throughout the state. And I think
Jack, I appreciate it. I have a feeling the folks in this room aren't making those decisions, but the publishers are, right?
Right. There's always your public library.
Yeah. Thank you.
They have subscriptions.
Thanks.
I mean, you raise a really good point, but there is a cost to producing the news and the editorial pages. I mean, people are used to paying in print, and early on we gave them things for free online and perhaps set up the wrong expectation. But there's a cost to produce journalism no matter how you access it, whether it's on print or online. And unfortunately, it's just a business. We have to cover those costs, and that's what we're doing through online subscriptions, just like we ask people to pay for their newspaper.
Right. Okay, thanks, Jack. An email from Mike, which is how I wanted to wrap up this program anyway. He says, please mention how our state bird has flown into an avian kerfuffle. Please speak or sing out now in defense of the black-capped chickadee. And so there is a debate underway in the legislature and beyond about what is the Maine state bird. Apparently, the chickadee is not a specific enough bird. That somebody said saying chickadee is like saying pizza. It's not. It's not a type of chickadee. Greg, the Portland Press Herald did an online poll. Did the boreal chickadee, the black cap chickadee, or one of the other birds that you mentioned win?
I'm ashamed to say I don't know. I didn't look it up. I mean, for me personally, this I just look at this and I'm in terror that I'm going to run a picture of the wrong one. That's my only my main connection to this story. I don't really care which is the state bird. I just want to make sure I don't anger the boreal chickadee fans.
Susan, do you have a bird in this fight? Do you care?
At the risk of offending people, it seems like it needs to be the black cap chickadee. Your caller asked us to sing. I mean, that's the song we know, chickadee dee 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 dee. And that's what we think of when we think of a chickadee. And the boreal chickadee apparently doesn't even have a song. I mean, not trying to insult the poor bird. And, you know, with climate change, maybe they're not going to be here anymore. You know, I don't have strong feelings, but I guess I'm going with the black cap.
Yeah.
And Ben, apparently this has come up before. This isn't the first time we've, as a state, discussed which is our chickadee. And people have kind of, I've been a bit chicken about making a call, haven't
ooh,
they?
Ooh, yeah, I mean, I think this was from the 20s when they named the chickadee. At some point, they put it on the license plate. And so someone decided which chickadee to put on the license plate. So maybe we should find that person and see.
I bet it's Mark McCullough.
I don't even know.
Works for U.S. Fish and Wildlife. Uh-huh. He's done all the great art for the state license plate. Oh, so you're right. We should ask him.
I didn't know this difference before this story, I guess. looking at the pictures, I think the black-capped one is what I considered a chickadee. It's what you see on most pictures and stuff. But, this comes up every session. There seems to be something. We were fighting over whoopie pies a few years ago, and it kind of takes on this outsized importance because it's at least something we can fight about and not end up, hating each other.
Well, and maybe,
maybe
by this time,
I don't know.
Maybe we'll see. I don't know. Don't speak too quickly. Yeah.
Maybe by this time next month.
It's a cautionary tale to not try and pick the state dog.
Right. I like the new flag. I think we should. The new old flag.
I do too. Well,
we are
out of time. Thank you always for all three of you joining us. That's Susan Young with the Bangor Daily News, Ben Bragdon, the Kennebec Journal, a Morning Sentinel, and Central Maine Sunday, and Greg Kessich for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram editorial page editors. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.